This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing absolute return funds for all kinds of investors. Details at putnam.com. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The Obama administration has made its first withdrawal from the TARP, $386 million handed out to almost two dozen banks. That's practically small change when you consider the size of the whole bailout. And the Treasury Secretary said today it's high time that program had some rules. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Cargill. Collaborate, create, succeed. This is how Cargill works with customers. Stories online at cargillcreates.com. And by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build stronger customer relationships through email marketing. ConstantContact.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you with us on this Tuesday. It is the 27th of January. President Obama went up to Capitol Hill today to have a chat with the loyal opposition. He met with Republican members of both chambers to talk stimulus. As you might expect, he asked they put political differences aside when the $825 billion package comes up for a vote tomorrow in the House. Fresh off his swearing-in last night, the new Treasury Secretary, Timothy Geithner, jumped right into things. Geithner announced new rules today on how government bailout money is going to be handed out. This is the $350 billion the Obama administration has left from the original TARP. And the rules are designed to limit lobbying by companies that want to get their hands on some of the cash. The rules are still pretty vague, though, and they don't apply to the lobbying that goes on Capitol Hill. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer explains.
The Treasury Department's press release trumpets a new level of openness and accountability. But Treasury won't comment beyond that, which leaves a big question unanswered. What to do about banks that lobby lawmakers? Treasury decides who gets the bailout money, but already some banks have won big chunks of cash after their representatives put in a good word. How difficult will it be to control that? Mary Boyle is with Common Cause.
It's going to be very difficult. You know, that's among the many million-dollar questions here.
Massey Rich thinks he knows the answer. He's with the Center for Responsive Politics. He says Treasury won't be able to ignore those phone calls from Congress, especially since the Obama administration may be asking lawmakers for more money to shore up the financial system.
If there are two banks and one is in the district of a lawmaker on a financial committee, then they're probably going to side with the bank in the district of the person who will control whether there's additional money available.
Still, both Rich and Boyle say Treasury is making a good faith effort. Bill Isaac isn't so sure. He's a former FDIC chairman. He says Treasury's new rules are vague for a reason.
Usually when things are vague, it's because nobody wants them to really bite.
Isaac says Treasury is a political animal itself and can't escape lobbyists' influence. He says a more independent agency like the FDIC or the Fed should be in charge of the bailout cash. The chances of that?
Somewhere between slim and none.
In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
As I think we've mentioned a couple of times, the government is getting the cash to plug the holes in the banking industry two different ways. One, it's borrowing by selling treasury bonds. And two, it's printing money, printing like crazy. And that, the printing money part, is traditionally a recipe for a couple of equally bad things. Rampant inflation, which we haven't got yet because the rest of the economy is still tracking. Also, a falling dollar. But in fact, the greenback's holding up pretty well. So we asked Ashley Milne-Tite to look into why the old rules don't seem to apply anymore.
The U.S. economy may be battered, but Jos Worso, senior executive vice president for Union Bank, says currency buyers are still willing to place bets on the dollar.
People, I think, are buying the dollar right now because there's so much uncertainty in the world that they can't really figure out who's weaker than the other guy. And when that's the case, they kind of revert to old habits, which is the dollar is still the ultimate safe haven, and that's what we're going to buy.
Wyn Thin, currency strategist with Brown Brothers Harriman, points to something else. He says, sure, with the government printing money and pouring it into the bailout, you might expect the dollar to weaken. But he says that scenario would assume there'd be a glut of dollars floating around.
But what we're finding is that there really is not excessive supply out there, that in some instances there's actually been a shortage of dollars that have built up in the market.
Because, he says, banks are sitting on their cash, not lending it out, and because foreigners need dollars to buy all those treasury bills. On the other side of the world, the yen is strong too. Like the US, Japan is printing money to bail out its financial system, and its interest rates are also near zero. Axel Merck is president of Merck Investments.
As long as the Bank of Japan is not intervening in the currency markets, that whenever we have this panic that the financial system may implode, there's a flight over to the Japanese yen precisely for that reason.
Investors are putting money into Japan and the US because they think their economies will not only survive, but thrive. In New York, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
We told you yesterday about the good news, bad news in the housing industry, that home sales were up, used home sales, that is. But with all the foreclosures, prices are still falling. Today, it's straight bad news, no real upside. The S&P Case-Shiller Index came out this morning. Home prices were off 18% in November from a year ago. Although, now that I think about it, maybe there is one quick upside. The data in that report is from before mortgage rates tumbled at the end of 08. On Wall Street today, no tumbling at all. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. For the first time in a good long while, the Federal Reserve meeting that started this afternoon isn't about interest rates. The federal funds rate, the short-term rate that Bernanke and the gang do control, is already at 0.25%, its lowest ever. The Fed's been making loans and guaranteeing assets for a year or more, and still, there's no sign of recovery. Commentator Krishna Guha says there is lots more the Fed can do, but there's a catch.
There's a risk this week's Fed policy meeting could be a bit of a damp squib, at least compared with the last one, when rates were slashed and a radical new policy framework emerged. There's a lot more the Fed would like to do to revitalize credit markets, but the law prevents it from taking much credit risk. So in order to expand its riskier lending operations, it needs capital from Treasury's TARP fund to absorb likely losses. The Obama Treasury might not be ready to give the Fed the money just yet, and it might not want the Fed to take all the credit for what are, after all, Fed-Treasury joint ventures. The market won't take too kindly, though, to any suggestion that the Fed is in effect on hold, so here's what I would like to see. First, the Fed should expand their existing scheme that provides low-cost money to investors willing to buy consumer and small business loans packaged as securities. By supporting the secondary market for these securities, the Fed can revitalize the primary markets where these loans are made. This would require additional Treasury risk capital. Second, they need a similar scheme to finance investors willing to buy commercial real estate and jumbo residential mortgage-backed securities to bring these markets back to life too. Again, this would require more risk capital from Treasury. But one thing the Fed can do without the need for more Treasury support is to step up the rate at which they're buying Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac mortgage-backed securities and debt. In bang-for-the-buck terms, buying Fannie and Freddie paper makes more sense than buying U.S. Treasuries. Finally, the Fed should seek the authority from Congress to issue its own debt to help it manage the wind down of all these lending operations once the crisis is over. Will anything on my list come to pass? I think everything will, sooner or later, but exactly when is harder to tell. The Obama team may well be forthcoming, but they seem to dislike incremental intervention and might be storing up ammunition for a big bang in mid-February. That could leave the Fed treading water for a while, an uncomfortable prospect for investors and the economy.
Krishna Guha is the U.S. economics editor for the Financial Times. Send us your thoughts about what you hear on the program, or if you happen to know what a damp squib is. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. going to be physical violence aplenty during the Super Bowl this coming weekend, but the NFL's got nothing on the UFC. Ultimate Fighting Championship 94 is this Saturday. For the uninitiated, yours truly included, UFC, or as it prefers to be known, mixed martial arts, is the most recent sport to capture the imaginations and the wallets of young men. Bloody noses and black eyes are the least of it, or perhaps they are why MMA has taken off over the past few years. John Wertheim tracks the rise of UFC in his new book, Blood in the Cage, it's called. John, welcome to the program.
Thanks. Good to be here.
I'm going to guess, just based sheerly on demographics, that quite possibly a lot of public radio listeners aren't familiar with UFC and mixed martial arts. So set the scene for us. What is this creature?
I think you're right. I mean, the creature is this phenomenally successful and phenomenally popular sport that was residing very much on the margins and in the underground. It's gradually becoming more mainstream. And it exists mostly in pay-per-view, this dominant league, the UFC, the Ultimate Fighting Championships. And it's tapped into something. I mean, more males in that magic 18 to 34 demographic will pay to watch these fights than will watch, you know, college football bowl games or NBA playoff games for free.
Give us the atmospherics. It is, in essence, two guys in a cage, an octagon, right, beating the snot out of each other.
More or less, they're additional bodily fluids beyond snot. But it's not as barbaric as you might think. The cage is a little off-putting. If this were in a ring, I think it would be more palatable. But it's trained martial artists, and it's, you know, stand-up, it's punching and kickboxing, but it's also wrestling and jiu-jitsu, and they fight each other, but they don't have the anger. I mean, it's not a street fight where you have this emotion. I mean, this is just a sport. They fight, the fight ends, they shake hands, and they walk out.
How did it make that leap, though, from literally being banned in the United States practically? I mean, it was not allowed on pay-per-view, and now it's on network television.
Well, I think it was two things. I think it was just sort of survival instincts. They realized they had to clean it up, so they instituted weight classes, and they embraced regulation, and the caliber of fighters got a lot better. But they had this reality show on the Spike Network. And what this did, it sort of served as a big infomercial from the sport. And people saw what this was and what it wasn't, that it was a violent sport, but that it wasn't completely barbaric. There were rules. And I think it sort of helped demystify this a little bit.
You know, John McCain, when he was running the Commerce Committee in the Senate, leaned on the FCC to keep mixed martial arts off pay-per-view and off the airwaves. Do you think government has sort of backed away a little bit now and they're willing just to let it go and let the states try to figure it out?
I do. You know, it was John McCain who called this human cockfighting, which is one of those labels that 10 years later is still stuck. And you don't hear that kind of language anymore. McCain hasn't made that remark in several years. I think a few things are going on. I mean, I think this is getting more legitimate and people are realizing that states are sanctioning this and it's not the UFC that it was 10 years ago. But also, I do think the economy is playing a role here, that if the UFC were to come to New York tomorrow, they'd sell out Madison Square Garden. And, state budgets being what they are, I do think that some of these legislatures are softening their stance in part because of economics.
So what's the future then, John, of mixed martial arts and UFC and how acceptable it's going to be?
You know, I think it's interesting that not only are people buying this, but I walk by in Manhattan even, where it's not even sanctioned again. You walk by these karate dojos and there are signs in the window saying, we do mixed martial arts, we teach mixed martial arts. And I think that ultimately bodes just as favorably as the pay-per-view buys. People are actually doing this. I think that one fatality and all bets are off, but boy, I don't see a lot of things slowing this down.
John Wertheim's a senior writer at Sports Illustrated. His book about mixed martial arts is called Blood in the Cage. John, thanks a lot.
Pleasure. Thanks.
Not too long ago, Bernie Madoff was a superstar money manager. At the moment, he's under house arrest in New York, which helps explain why he wasn't sitting in front of the Senate Banking Committee today. Top federal regulators were summoned to explain why they missed the red flags as Madoff pulled off one of the biggest investor frauds in history, $50 billion worth. The marketplace players wonder if perhaps the Senate is interested in more than just fixing the holes in financial regulation.
Mr. Regulator, let me get this straight. Bernard Madoff allegedly set up what is called a Ponzi scheme?
That's correct.
In which he allegedly earned billions out of basically nothing?
Yes, sir.
Could you explain to this committee the concept of a Ponzi scheme? Because it sounds kind of awesome.
Yeah.
I hear that. Excuse me?
The government is also currently in possession of a whole lot of nothing, Mr. Regulator.
Yes, and it would be very helpful to know how to make a few billion off it.
Okay. It's like a pyramid scheme?
Oh, pyramids, they're pretty.
No, it's a scheme where you pay off one investor with money you get from other investors.
But how do they get paid?
With money you get from more investors.
So, sort of like what we've been doing with China.
Kind of. But wait, the U.S. government can't do a Ponzi scheme.
Why not? They say Madoff did it. They say he did it for years.
Look, if he did, it's only because we weren't paying enough attention to stop him.
Well, why don't we just continue not paying attention?
Well, that's a good idea. Yeah, and then maybe we could just take a piece of his action.
Yeah.
And just a teeny piece. I'm sure he wouldn't mind.
It's against the law.
Oh.
Well, what if we blackmailed some cash out of Bill Gates? Is that illegal?
Yes.
Oh, man. Session adjourned.
As ever, Rico Galliano wrote that piece for us. You heard him and Brendan Noonan and Michelle Philippi in there as well. You can hear more from Rico and Brendan at our website. It's marketplace.org. Coming up, entrepreneurs who aren't discouraged by the recession.
He fills a vapor balloon with a lavender aroma, and the plate of food is placed on top of that. The aroma is slowly released during the course of the meal, and it really infuses the palate of the diner.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials rose almost 0.75% today, 58 points, closed at 81.74. The NASDAQ finished up more than 1%, 15 points, ended at 15.04. The S&P 500 also climbed above 1%, or 9 points, closed at 8.45. Existing orders for steel pipe brought a fourth quarter jump in profits for U.S. Steel. Shares closed nearly 7% higher, but the company warned it does expect sales to fall. Quarterly earnings at American Express beat expectations, giving a charge to the company's stock. It charged up almost 10% today. Shareholders of Hershey's got some early Valentine's chocolate. Net profit during the all-important Halloween to holidays period hit more than $82 million. Hershey's closed up more than 6% today. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.53%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the Repossessing Virtue Project. Engage with wise voices on the economic downturn from moral and ethical perspectives at speakingoffaith.org. Want more from Marketplace's special Fallout coverage? It's all on our website. You'll find special podcasts, videos, and the Marketplace Decoder, a simple guide to financial terms and products. Go to marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. The Federal Open Market Committee wraps up its first meeting of the year. The agenda? Probably looking at ways out of the recession. A House Committee on Transportation examines the impact of the economy on the nation's railroad industry. And the Republican National Committee convenes its annual winter meeting in Washington. I'm Michelle Philippi.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. The competition during the Super Bowl on Sunday is not going to be limited just to the Pittsburgh Steelers and the Arizona Cardinals. Marketing professionals will be gunning for the honor of running the best ad. They'll be paying as much as $3 million for 30 seconds of airtime. It's a lot of money in a boom, let alone a recession. So Rob Walker's with us to talk about the merits and the possible pitfalls of advertising in the Super Bowl this year. He writes the Consumed column for the New York Times Magazine. Hey, Rob.
Thanks for having me, Kai.
So you would think, given the way the economy is, that the Super Bowl and its ad territory would not necessarily be the bazillion-dollar extravaganza it always is. But somehow, these spots are expensive again this year.
Yeah, once again, breaking all previous records. And, you know, one of the explanations is this is the last great forum like this. There is no other single event that the entire country gathers around, and that's still a valuable thing, no matter what the economy is.
But do you think those ads pay off?
They can. I think that what's changed in how that is sort of measured isn't just the ad itself, but kind of the hype around the ad, both before and after. And I think the advertising agencies are very aware of this, and you know, they put the spots on YouTube sometimes in advance to run up the sort of total number of YouTube views and stuff like this so they can claim that their ad was a cultural phenomenon.
We will see once again this year, obviously, Budweiser complete with Clydesdales. But some companies that have never been in the Super Bowl are going to be there this year. One of them is Pedigree, the dog food company. And they've got this ad going this year that's got, I guess, hippopotamuses and rhinoceroses and ostriches. And the tagline is, isn't it time to think about a dog? Let's roll a little bit of that tape.
Come on, Rusty. Come on, let's go for a walk. Rusty!
Morning, Mrs. Lawrence. Not again.
Bruno, come back here. Bruno, you bad, bad bird.
The Pedigree Adoption Drive. Help us help dogs.
Why would Pedigree get in the Super Bowl now? Is it a case of, do you think, that the place to take risks is when the economy is bad and maybe you might get the bigger payoff?
Yeah, for companies that are in a position to do that, that's, I think, exactly what they're thinking, is that, you know, they're looking around, they're seeing, well, if my competitors are too scared to do this, then I'm gonna seize market share. People, you know, people still have to buy dog food. No one's spending really goes to zero in a bad economy. People are going to be out there spending money, and they want to get in front of you and make you think about them as one of the places that you'll spend your money.
Let me get you to what we might call the anti-ads here for a second. Budweiser, I talked about. They'll be there with Clydesdales and all of that. Miller High Life, though, is going to run a one-second ad in some markets, poking fun at Budweiser for spending all that money on 30 seconds of ad time. They've put together a couple of preview one-second shots. Let's listen to a couple of those.
Miller time. Champagne and beers. Bean dip. Bonjour, Milwaukee. One Mississippi.
So we ran a couple of them together. That was 5 seconds worth of one-second ads. What do you think about that strategy?
I think it's actually incredibly clever, and in no small part because of what I was talking about earlier, that it's not just about an ad that runs during the Super Bowl. It's about how much of the hype you can kind of get in on, all of the pre-Super Bowl advertising roundups and the post-Super Bowl advertising roundups. And Miller has inserted itself into that story.
What about opportunity cost here? That is, people who are usually in the Super Bowl but aren't this year. Good move, bad move?
Well, the one that leaps to mind is GM. And, you know, I'm sure if they had their druthers, they would be doing it. And I don't even know if you can characterize it as a strategic decision. I mean, they're literally borrowing money from us right now. So they have to pinch whatever pennies they can. The one way you don't want to be part of the Super Bowl ad roundup stories is to be the company being mentioned as not being able to afford to be there.
Yeah, right. Good point. Rob Walker writes the Consumed column for the New York Times Magazine. He's also an occasional commentator for this program. Rob, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Some of those ads we were talking about are pretty funny. You can see them for yourself at our website, marketplace.org. This next item is for the foodies among us. A lot of people are reaching for generic cereals and searching out two-for-one deals. But even in a recession, there is money to be made in food, especially at the high end. Plenty of entrepreneurs are trying to break into the $48 billion specialty food market. But April Demboski reports a lot of those newcomers aren't driven by a dream of huge profits.
The economy was on everyone's mind at this month's fancy food show in San Francisco. The makers of such delicacies as Italian truffle salt and fennel pâté are trying to appeal to reluctant consumers with smaller, cheaper portions. But some of the companies here for the first time came with a more personal motivation.
My dad loved beef jerky. We all do.
Marisa Wayne is the daughter of actor John Wayne. Her brother Ethan is taking the family business in a new direction. Before, it was just a licensing company.
We've licensed products like, you know, plates with this picture on it, or mugs, or cups, or shot glasses, or firearms, or lottery tickets, slot machines, etc.
But he wanted to develop his own products that honored his dad. At the show, he unveiled 6 varieties of John Wayne's Stock and Supply beef jerky, all natural and organic.
you know, as kids, whether we were on location with him or on our boat, we ate a lot of beef jerky. So we became, I don't know what you'd call it, beef jerky connoisseurs.
Part of the proceeds will go to the John Wayne Cancer Foundation. But for Ethan and his four brothers and sisters, the product is also about doing right by their dad.
You know, we always talk about, like, one day we'll have to see him again, and we want to make sure that, you know, whatever we make pleases him.
For husband and wife team Dan and Jean Ehrlich, the inspiration for their product was music. They both play in several rock bands and run a music website. After late-night rehearsals, they're often hungry.
What's open late at night? 7-Eleven or On the Go? Some place that, you know, you're lucky if there's a banana you can eat.
So they started making a snack called Hippie Chips, a potato and rice puff baked with hemp seed. They see the anti-Dorito quality as just one benefit.
What we do on the back of every bag is promote independent artists and bands. And you can go to the website and listen to their music.
On the other side of the convention center is a very unexpected exhibitor. Beck Maxwell is the vice president of Volcano Vaporization System in Oakland, California. His product hit the market in 2003, but not the food market.
It was widely adopted by the cannabis community as a non-smoke means of delivering the active ingredients in cannabis.
People who recognize the vaporizer stop at his booth, perplexed. Then Maxwell demonstrates the device's culinary uses. He puts a pinch of cloves and tangerine peel into the machine. The air around the table fills with a fresh scent of spices and citrus.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, cool. Wow. Check it out.
Chefs visiting the table have been impressed with how the Volcano might change the high-end dining experience. Award-winning chef Grant Atkins has used it at his restaurant in Chicago.
He fills a vapor balloon with a lavender aroma. He places that inside of a pillowcase and then perforates that pillowcase. And the plate of food is placed on top of that. The aroma is slowly released during the course of the meal, and it really infuses the palate of the diner.
Retailing at nearly $700, the Volcano Vaporizer may take some time to catch on in culinary circles. In San Francisco, I'm April Demboski for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering absolute return funds with goals designed to match yours. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note today, the first bill that President Obama is going to sign is on the way to his desk. The House passed what's being called the Lilly Ledbetter Law this afternoon. The Senate passed it yesterday. Ledbetter is the woman who lost her pay discrimination case in the Supreme Court in 2007. The justices ruled she had waited too long to file suit. Once the president signs it, the act extends the statute of limitations in cases like that. Ledbetter didn't find out she was getting less than her male colleagues until she was getting close to retirement. She told the Associated Press that Obama promised her he'd see her at the White House for the signing ceremony. We will see you tomorrow. That is Marketplace from American Public Media this Tuesday afternoon. Today, the Dow rose almost 0.75%, 58 points, closed at 81.74. The NASDAQ finished up more than 1%, 15 points, ended at 15.04. The S&P 500 also climbed more than 1%, 9 points, closed at 8.45. Thanks to Jennifer Collins and Renita Jablonski on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by John Buckley. Coming up next time on this program in Miami, putting homeless people into people-less homes.
This is going to be our seventh move-in into a foreclosed unit.
Oh, my goodness. I haven't had keys in months.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdal. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? Don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.